Der deutsche Spargelkult müsse enden.
Germany's beleaguered defense minister has temporarily dropped his PhD title.
Volkswagen ist eine Perle der deutschen Industrie. Und ich glaube, das kann man
sagen. Ich weiß, wie viel Liebe dahinter steckt. Wenn Glühweinstände aufgebaut werden, wenn Waffen...
Spargel-Weltmeister ist China, denn die bauen 60 Mal mehr...
Hey, this is Ted. Welcome to Spaßbremse. Quick intro here before we get to a really fun interview with Quinn Slobodian, who's a historian of ideas at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. First of all, thanks to everyone who listens and especially to those who support us on Patreon. To access our ever-growing archive of premium episodes, which range in topics from things like German youth parties most recently, to topics like companies during the Nazi era, and more fun things like asparagus and sparkling water, you can subscribe to the link in the show notes. Your support also makes free interviews like this one possible. In this episode, Quinn and I sat down to discuss his scholarly work, his thoughts on modern German politics, and some big picture ideas about the relationship between capitalism and democracy, among other things. We also get into the very small country of Liechtenstein, which features in his most recent book. Liechtenstein would be the sixth smallest country in the world by area. It's got Austria to the east, Switzerland to the west, and Germany, Lake Constance area, up to the north. So in addition to relating to these themes of capitalism, democracy, zones that we get into, you can also see this interview as part one of our series on Germany's neighbors that we've been planning. More on that later. The two books we discuss are Globalists, The End of Empire and the Birth of Neoliberalism, which was published in 2018 by Harvard University Press, and it shows how neoliberal thinkers after the fall of the Habsburg Empire after World War I worked to protect global capitalism from democracy, using international institutions and the power of the state to encase the market, in Quinn's terminology, which eventually resulted in the creation of modern entities like the World Trade Organization. The second book is his more recent book from this year, called Crack Up Capitalism, Market Radicals and the Dream of a World Without Democracy, published by Metropolitan Books. It looks at zones or specific territories that are exempt from certain types of economic regulation, such as taxation, tariffs, or democratic oversight in general, and also discusses the thinkers who advance these zones as a solution to the troubled relationship between capitalism and democracy. They're both great books, and I highly recommend reading both if you haven't already. Just one small correction before we get going. In the interview, I mistakenly refer to the fictional bridges on the euro currency as having been built for the purpose of depicting them on the currency. If you pull out your wallet, you'll see a bridge on the euro banknotes. But at the time of the euro currency's introduction, those bridges didn't actually exist anywhere in Europe. However, someone in 2011 in the Netherlands decided to build actual physical versions of all of those over a decade after the bills had been in circulation. So basically, I stated it in the reverse. The fake bridges on the currency predate the physical manifestation of the fake bridges in the real world. But I think this is actually a fitting anecdote, because you'll see that this pattern of dreaming things up for the purpose of further expanding capitalism, only to then build a physical manifestation of it, is a pretty common one in Quinn's work, and something we get into quite a bit in the interview. And without any further delay, we'll cut to me and Quinn. Thanks. Hey, this is Ted. Welcome to Spaßbremse. I'm here in Berlin, joined by a very special guest I'm excited to have on and discuss with. It's Quinn Slobodian, author of the recent book Crack Up Capitalism, and previously, from I believe 2018, Globalists. And so I wanted to take a chance to talk to him about both his work and how it also ties into our current political moment, especially both of us sitting here in Berlin in a sort of summer of disquiet in German politics, with the rise of the far right seeming to be ongoing and no one quite sure when it'll hit its peak. And so I think a lot of Quinn's work ties very well into that, and I'm really excited to discuss with him. So thanks so much for coming on.
For sure. Happy to be here.
Quinn is a professor of history at Wellesley and luckily is over here in Berlin for the summer. So we're actually able to not do this over Zoom. Before we get into some of the specific cases from your recent book, which is about economic zones, like free trade zones, export processing zones, tax havens. And I want to zoom in on one particular case because obviously we're a podcast about Germany or the German-speaking world more broadly. And so there's a very fun case study in your book about Liechtenstein, which is a really crazy case. But it represents a lot of the core kind of themes that you get at in your work. But before we get to the specific case, could you just talk a little bit about your two books and why you set out to write them and how their message and content tied into the economic moment when they were written or when you were writing them?
Sure. Yeah. So Globalist, as you say, was published in 2018, but it was actually more or less finished already in the spring of 2016. Then my son had the ill behavior and the rudeness to be born at that time and kind of delay everything by about a year. So the book in its conception and its execution is very much a kind of a pre-Trump, pre-Brexit book. I think it's a book of the Obama years. It's a book of the post-Eurozone crisis. It's a book of the post-global financial crisis. And it was kind of, you know, doing what I tend to do, which is to say, like, how can a historian be of service here? Because I knew that there were political theorists and sociologists like Wolfgang Strake or people in the so-called new constitutionalism school like Stephen Gill who were making a lot of observations about the way that the new multilateral institutions that have been put in place since the end of the Cold War had kind of tied the hands of democratic electorates, locked in certain kinds of capitalist freedoms, constrained others, sort of put us on a kind of a locked course towards a particular political economy, which was not, in my opinion, enriching the majority of people, but was actually enriching the few and creating a sense of discontent, mostly because of the narrowness of the space for possibilities of political self-expression as well. So I knew that they were saying that. And then when they tried to write the history of that or gesture at the history of that, a Strake or a Gill, often they would do so in what to me were rather kind of superficial ways. So they would sort of say, this is all Friedrich Hayek's doing, or this is all James M. Buchanan's doing. And as a historian, I was a little unsatisfied with the lack of footnotes to statements like that. It was just sort of like these walk-on cameos of the origins of the ideas without, you know, doing the kind of paper trail, which, you know, as an intellectual historian, political historian, a historian in general, you know, our thing is kind of like, show me the archive. So in a way, the Globalist book was just kind of like, I am incensed. I am also I also feeling disempowered. I feel like politics has been set onto a path that is not the doing of the majority of people. How do we write the intellectual history of that in a responsible way? So I went back into the history of someone like Hayek and ended up back in the end of the Habsburg Empire talking about Mises and Hayek and Machloup and Haberler and a whole host of these dinosaurs that had sort of emerged from the wreckage of the Habsburg world and, you know, hazarded also kind of provocative, but one a provocative thesis, but one I would say with an archival paper trail, which is that you can see the kind of global economic governance of the late 20th century, of the 1990s, the early 2000s, in a way as the realization of a kind of scaled up macro version of the fallen Austro-Hungarian Empire of the early 20th century, or at least the one that existed in the minds of certain Austrian neoliberals. So I was, you know, just kind of trying to still work through my kind of late 90s demons, my kind of like didn't go to the WTO protests in Seattle, even though it was a short drive away, kind of like, you know, problem, a psychological problem. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of trying to do that, Trump was elected, Brexit happened, and this globalization consensus, which seemed like it was going to go on forever, was suddenly like lying in, you know, shards all around me. And what I had written as a kind of history of the present was actually a history of the recent past. So that made it, I think, an interesting book for people to engage with, because they could engage with it both as a kind of document of the recent past, but also it then became a question of like, well, is this really what we want to reestablish? Like, do we want to just go back to this? And some of the people in the book, like some sort of card-carrying neoliberals, definitely read it that way. So they, you know, people who appear in like chapter 7 review the book and say like, this book is great because it shows us the globalism that was lost in 2016. And it gives us a roadmap to how we can put it back together. Not my intended reading of the book, but, you know, fair enough from their particular perspective.
This is the funny part about your work, is that the people you kind of target as, this is my word, but enemies, then you're, you know, you take them seriously and aren't uncharitable. But, you know, you can read, if you read the text, it's clear that, you know, you're not agreeing with them ideologically. But these same people then will read the book and be like, this is cool. We're so awesome. Like, yeah, we are actually protecting the market from like democratic oversight. I've heard someone on Twitter equate it to mob guys watching like The Godfather and being like, yeah, this rules. Like, we look so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was Richard Seymour, I think, had that observation. That sort of like, you know, two-bit gangsters watching Scarface and like imagining them like these grandiose visions of themselves. So yeah, there might be some of that, and that sort of spills over into the newer project too. So the sort of bridge between that first book, or the first book in this sequence, Globalists, and the one that followed, which is called Crack Up Capitalism, The Dream of a World Without Democracy, Market Radicals and the Dream of a World Without Democracy, long subtitle, which came out in 2023.
This year, this has been a long year.
Yes, yeah. 2023.
I swear that was just a few months ago. Yeah.
So that one then, I think, came out with me trying to sort of get my head around what happened since 2016, right? And there, you know, it's like I'm constantly like slaying these dragons, which by the time I'm done slaying them, like, then I'm like flogging a dead horse, sort of, because it's like, you know, the mixed metaphor is intentional, which is like, for 2 years after Trump and Brexit, everyone was like, this is a backlash against globalization, right? Global capitalism has produced these monsters, and now they want to destroy global capitalism. And so for 2 years, at least, I was just like on a broken record, kind of repeat saying like, no, saying what I think is obvious, which is just like, Trump does not hate capitalism. Boris Johnson does not hate capitalism. Jacob Rees-Mogg does not hate capitalism. This is more of a front lash than a backlash. But because I think in our heads we collapsed globalism of a particular variety, that like managed by multilateral institutions, and capitalism and neoliberalism all as kind of a series of like equivalent terms, when someone broke with part of that, it was assumed that they were breaking with all of it. And so the Crack Up Capitalism book was really me trying to say, no, there are people who would be against the WTO, who would be against the IMF, who'd even be against the UN, who would nevertheless be like capitalist radicals. And although Trump is a complicated case, we can think about, or we can helpfully have in mind that what can look like a backlash, a kind of Polanyian double movement, isn't always that. And sometimes it's actually an attempt to kind of accelerate forces of capitalism rather than kind of put a brake on them.
This whole backlash against globalization thesis, it seems like it gets the first part right, that the economic order that you talk about being created in your first book, that, as you say,
had,
you know,
effects, yeah.
Yeah, it had effects, and it has a lot of, you know, a lot of disenfranchised people and a lot of disillusioned people, that there is a backlash to it electorally or politically, but that doesn't mean it goes in, like you said, this sort of Polanyian, like exact counter movement. Like the backlash doesn't have to undo the thing. It can just lead in another direction, or as you say, an acceleration.
Yeah. Or, you know, talented political entrepreneurs can spot the reservoirs of resentment and then tap into those for their own purposes that might be very different from the perceived solutions that those aggrieved populations might have. And I mean, that's not a speculation. That's exactly, I think, the way to understand Trump and Brexit, which is you had basically, indeed, parts of the population who had been hard done by from a redistributive sense, and also affective in terms of their subjectivity, in terms of their lines of political influence, had been choked out and strangled from the 90s to the 2010s. And so there's that, what Danny Roderick and other people would call kind of like the demand side of populism, the term that they like to use. You know, like there's people who are like pissed and they want a solution. And then you have someone like the Leave wing or the Leave faction of the Brexit of the Conservative Party, or, you know, Arthur Laffer, like father of the supply of the Laffer curve, the father of supply side economics, advising Trump, who are like, ooh, this is nice. Like, we can get like chumps in the Midwest to vote for something, a giant tax cut that actually definitely just continues in the exact same fashion the very economic patterns that had been disenfranchising them in the first place. So I think it's like it's not either or, it's both and, which is like, yes, there is a reservoir of resentment that was produced by like the distributive effects of globalization, but it was mostly being capitalized on by people who had no interest in remedying those things. And that side of things, the kind of the emergence of a kind of anti-globalist ultra-capitalism, was something I just found like mainstream pundits just like unable to see, like again and again, which I found so weird.
Yeah. And you, as you said in the New Statesman, we don't get a crisis of democracy because capitalism is not working. We get a crisis of democracy because capitalism is working very well on its own terms. And that's counteracting this pat liberal view of the 2016 rupture, which is that, you know, there must be a problem with the economic order if people are so angry. And as you say, well, no, this is literally what it was designed to do. And maybe people didn't want this political backlash, but the economic outcomes are very obvious to see for several decades.
Yeah. And I mean, I think Martin Wolf is someone who I think a lot about when I think about the stuff I write about, which is the relationship between democracy and capitalism. Because he's someone who is like, I think, one of the smarter versions of the people who don't get it. Like he's like the smartest guy who doesn't know what's going on.
The Financial Times economic columnist and author of The Crisis of Democratic Capitalism recently.
Yeah, most recently. And why, you know, why is that? Because he describes the relationship between democracy and capitalism as a kind of ballet, or not a ballet, a kind of a waltz, like a two-person dance. And what needs to be done is kind of like the choreography needs to be fixed. Like the conductor needs to like get the rhythm going again. And the marriage, which is what he calls a kind of like the strained marriage between democracy and capitalism, needs to be like mended by, I guess, the intervention of like a therapist who, I guess, he's giving himself that role. Like he's like the couple's counselor. And that the idea that is totally consistent from my like first book to this one, not only because Martin Wolf does play like a walk-on role in globalists, but the idea that there can be these kind of like imperial kind of civil servants, whether they're in, you know, the UK, a Whitehall, or in the center of the Habsburg Empire in Austria, in Vienna, the idea that there can be a kind of a position outside of the scrum of interests that can kind of adjudicate what is right, is, you know, that is the problem, right? Like that, and that is the thing that that has yet to be kind of, I think, perceived clearly. I'm right now just starting to read and for review Gordon Brown and Mohammed El Arian's book called Permacrisis and the Solutions to the apparently like our global conjuncture. I am frightened to read what I'm going to find
in there. Permacrises and polycrises.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. No, I'm really interested in that title too, because it's like, to me, permacrisis is like, gives a false sense of stability, right? Like, it's like permafrost. Like, you actually want permafrost. You know, permacrisis.
That's the thawing of it. That's the problem. Yeah.
Exactly. It would be the failure to have a crisis. But anyway, so to sum up, you know, I think that what I set out to do is to sort of say, like, we do have this thing which is ultra capitalism, which is also discontented with the kind of post Second World War and especially post Cold War kind of consensus on global economic governance. And so the question is, like, what I was trying to do was sort of throw out some lines of possible sort of intellectual lineage to say, you know, where has this come from, this idea of loving capitalism but hating globalism, and where could it go?
And as you put it, from one book to the other, we move from discussing encasing the market to perforating the state, as you put it. And throughout the two books, there's a few different themes and these set of relationships that you explore. And some in some there's more tension than others, and some are kind of falsely posed as opposites when they're actually not. And this is me just jotting down a few things. But the first one that you already mentioned is democracy versus capitalism. It's kind of the dream of the 90s that those always go hand in hand. And as you show, actually, there's a lot of people who are totally happy for there to be hyper-capitalism with no democracy. And that comes out in different ways in each book. One is, as you say, encasing it from democracy at the global level, and the other is creating these little zones below the level of the state where the market can also work without democratic oversight. There's the tension between the local and the international, and some there's different groups that fetishize each. But of course, the towering heights of global capitalism, as you show, especially in your most recent book, these really successful little economic miracles of these micro states or zones, they all depend on very specific features of geography, the labor availability, specific legal codes, just historical contingency in general. The third relationship would be state versus market. And these are often posed as opposites, so that there's, you know, are we going to have more market or more state? Right. And our economic system is sort of a question of how much we want one or the other.
On the spectrum, yeah.
Exactly. But as you show, of course, you need the state to protect the market. I mean, this is a commonly understood thing in terms of protecting property rights. But you go a lot deeper and show that even these so-called market radicals are actually big enthusiasts of the state and want to use it for coercive means and to limit democracy in specific cases. And the last one I have here is the pre-modern versus the post-modern. And this ties in a lot with the Liechtenstein example, which is that these market radicals and their dreams of the future, they often go back to medieval or ancient, I won't say history, more like their idea of what the history was.
The past, anyway, yeah.
Yeah. You know, small little commercial relationships, feudal legal codes, and so on. And they look to this past, often the Holy Roman Empire, sometimes Rome or Greece, and they say, you know, this is the model for the future. And so there's this weird tension between hyper-futurism and valorizing the Middle Ages, which are usually not held up as the peak of civilization.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'd say a couple of things. I think you're right in everything you're saying. I think that one of the things that happens in the course of the Crack Up Capitalism book, which I didn't really intend, it just kind of turned out that way, is that that state market spectrum you're describing gets kind of disturbed or like unsettled. So this is a part of, I think, the outcome of talking about the last book, the Globalist book, a lot, and being forced, as many like scholars of neoliberalism are, to like constantly reiterate the same point, which is like neoliberalism is not about getting rid of the state. It's actually about like repurposing the state and reformatting the state. And like, there's no one smart who's written about neoliberalism who hasn't said that, like, every few pages. And yet, it seems like one still needs to say that, or at least like when you're talking about the topic, people often say, yeah, it's quite interesting the way you note that like the state is still important. It's like, yes, yes, as everyone else has said, literally, like from like Loïc Wacant to like Wendy Brown to David Harvey, whatever. But in the back of my head when I was talking about it, I was always like, damn it, I know that there are actually some people in the broad neoliberal community who actually don't think that the state is necessary. And those people are kind of the most interesting ones. They believe you can actually escape that binary, that you are not trapped forever in the kind of Polanyian, realm of the movement, the slow like drift between unfetteredness and embeddedness, which I think that a lot of historical narratives and sociological narratives like either implicitly or explicitly assume. Instead, the anarcho-capitalists, of which the sort of the second half of the book is more or less devoted to, are actually chasing this dragon of no state, zero state, like a pure private ordering, not like capitalism in which, you know, most of the allocation of like scarce resources is taken care of by private actors, but like all resources. And so they are kind of like those are like the characters that I was really keen on like introducing into the intellectual history of neoliberalism, because the people who the book sort of begins with, like Milton Friedman talking about Hong Kong, Milton Friedman disparaging Singapore, but other neoliberals liking Singapore, the ambiguous position of a place like Dubai. Now, these are more clear-cut cases of like authoritarian capitalism running countries like corporations. The head of state acts like a CEO. And the sort of the master point, I think, in the book is that when we supposedly had the Fukuyama moment of democracy and capitalism, like reconciling themselves to one another at the end of the Cold War, we almost immediately, the first thing Fukuyama writes after the end of history is published is about the attractions of Asian soft authoritarianism. So, you know, it doesn't take long before like the most cliche mouthpiece of democracy and capitalism working together himself actually says like, yeah, but you know, sometimes it works great when you have less democracy, as in the cases of, you know, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, etc. So there's like the macro like historical point of the book is to say we need a better narrative of the post-Cold War era, where we shouldn't assume that democracy and capitalism worked well together until like supposedly 2016 came along and blew everything up, which I still don't understand, because, you know, like them or not, I mean, Trump and Brexit were democratic actions. They were not extra democratic, actually. But then the second thing I think is really to say, like, introduce these new entries into the cast of like market intellectuals, not the Milton Friedmans, but the David Friedmans, Milton Friedman's son, the Patry Friedmans, Milton Friedman's grandson. And then like a cast of even more like outre folks who weren't just trying to run, you know, countries like corporations, but were actually trying to go off and like found new experiments and like completely private governance. So there are people who I don't like politically, you know, at all. In fact, I feel strongly negative towards them. But they also have like a degree of fervor and kind of wholehearted commitment to their politics, which I think is admirable, or at least like is something that it would be nice to see leftists like living up to sometimes.
And it's too bad that when a lot of famous Marxist scholars, you know, their kids turn into complete centrists, like, you know, famously like Kamala Harris or, you know, Pete Buttigieg had these like very radical, or like the Milibands, like there's this sort of left academic to centrist pipeline.
Sure.
And it's unfortunate that that doesn't seem to operate quite as much on the right, where you have this Friedman lineage keep getting more and more radical. You're like, why can't we do that?
Yeah, no, it's true. So like the truly kind of funky intellectuals in the book, I think we're, you know, in some ways, I think every book is a memoir. Like, I have this firm belief, which is like every book like documents the state of mind that you were in when you were writing it, and by extension, the state of the world when you were writing it. And it's just, it can't be really avoided that we were in the middle of a global pandemic when I was like writing most of this book. And there's a certain degree of escapism, I think, in the structure of the book, and also a kind of attraction to people who were following things through to their most radical conclusions. So, I mean, I think I was probably not the only one watching like a lot of like reading a lot of like cyberpunk and like watching a lot of like hectic like anime like during lockdown. You know what I mean? Where you're just kind of like, I am stuck and totally immobile. I cannot move. What do I want? I want something that has like has extended the possibility of mobility to a point that it becomes like torture. So like maybe, you know, Neon Genesis Evangelion is like the solution to coronavirus. So there are the people who appear in the second half of the book, especially, are people who have just, you know, embraced that. They've found their kind of like October revolution in like the Somali Civil War, or like in the wake of a coup in Honduras, and or in like the extension of like blockchain technologies from cryptocurrency into you know, other domains, into Web3 and DAOs and things like that. Like, there are people who feel like they are in the kind of 1910s, like right now. And like, especially since the slowdown of the sort of Corbyn Sanders wave in the North Atlantic, you know, there's just not a lot of leftists of my kind of community that feel that sense of like historicity, you know, like that kind of urgency, like as Benjamin would call like Jetztzeit. But some of these, you know, anarcho-capitalists and libertarians really are like, this is our time.
Yeah, it's a phrase that was popular during the pandemic when online, when people would get a little too crazy, is touch grass, you know, like ground yourself, do something, like go outside, like be in touch with the real world. And yeah, you get that a little bit with some of your characters. Like, mm-hmm, these are some people
who could probably do with a little grass touching.
Yeah. And that brings me to this question, which is also relates to this, the New Statesman piece, the interview. I think the subheader of it said how Quinn Slobodian came back down to earth. And I wanted to ask if you would agree with that characterization of the second book as coming back down to earth, because while it discusses specific territories, mm-hmm, you also deal with thinkers who have their head in the clouds a lot more than the kind of, you know, Hayek set that you get into a little more in, mm-hmm, Globalist. So it's like, is crack-up capitalism more or less kind of concrete and grounded than globalists?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think that, again, like, the book kind of needs to be divided in half, I think. Like, I think it begins in Hong Kong, and I remain kind of, like, in awe of Hong Kong in many ways as a place. You mentioned historical contingency. I mean, you know, it's just, like, there's no reason for Hong Kong to be the place it is. Like, it was chance. It was, okay, it's a deep harbor. But like, other than that, it's just like, it's for a historian, it's kind of like catnip, because it's like, you just need to pile on these contingent events. You need to be like, you know, the Opium War, the scramble for concessions, you know, the success of the Chinese Communist Revolution, the extension of like containerization, the expansion of financial, like the end of the capital controls, the emergence of offshore Eurodollar markets, like 24-hour investment cycles. Like, there's just, it's a place where you can see global capitalism and modernity happening like in miniature. And so in that sense, you know, I did my best, I think, to kind of like do justice to the inhabitants of places like that. And like, I think that's where like the came down to earth thing is kind of valid, which is like, I did try to like give in as much as I could, like these little pen portraits of like locales and like what it meant to be living in Hong Kong or Singapore, you know, in those years, you know, in a short book and many chapters, it's hard to do. But so that part is true. But I think as far as the intentions of the protagonists, I think it's always extremely instrumental. So I think, you know, where the book ends up is in a place like this, this special economic zone, like plus, like a special kind of a special economic zone, on an island off the north coast of Honduras in the Caribbean. And there it's called Prospera. And it was, you know, the result of a lot of intellectual work and kind of fundraising and people like Patry Friedman and Joe Lonsdale and other people in the kind of Peter Thiel extended universe were directly engaged in it for years and years until it eventually got off the ground, where they had something like kind of almost extraterritorial status, like inside of the state of Honduras. And there, you know, why were they interested in, you know, had they come down to earth? Not at all. No, it was completely instrumental. Like if it wasn't there, it could be in the other places they'd tried things out, like Marshall Islands or like Kiribati. And now there's other sort of private city efforts happening across Southeast Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. So they had never came down to earth. I mean, their board of advisors was still, you know, Deloitte, people who worked on the Dubai International Financial Center, the Estonian dude who designed like their e-passport system. I mean, like, they were like as globalist as it comes, like themselves. And that's where actually, you know, some of the kind of drama of the book comes out in the end, or the friction, which is just like what happens when people who, for whom like one patch of the earth is as good as another, come into contact with people for whom like that patch of the earth happens to be the place that they call home. And there's no way around that basic problem. I mean, I had a conversation with a consultant who's worked in this private cities stuff for a long time. And the way he wanted to start the conversation with me was saying like, okay, like thought experiment, like what would you want to have a place where like your socialist principles could be played out and then my free market libertarian principles could be played out and we could just see who wins? And I was like, what is this place? And they're like, what is this place we speak of? Because isn't the whole story about the absence of such empty patches of territory upon which to like, you know, experiment, that there is no unoccupied part of the map? So I think part of it is as banal as that, which is just like the world is full of people. The world is already full of political claims making. And to believe you can start from a blank slate is like the highest form of delusion, even though it's very seductive. And it's simply the seduction of like settler colonialism, which is really at kind of at the heart of all of this too. So you have to go online, and it's no then coincidence that that is the kind of space where this imaginary is still most fertile, is this, you know, so far misfired, but who knows, idea of the metaverse, idea of kind of a virtual territory. And it's interesting how, you know, being in Berlin right now, how sort of contagious those sort of fantasies have been in the art world too. I mean, I could just walk by some art gallery. They had a piece called The Feral Metaverse. And I know there's a big thing at the Schinkel Pavilion that was like all about different ideas of the metaverse. It's now become almost like the first station of call for a new contemporary art exhibit. It's like something that combines, you know, virtual reality.
I saw an NFT convention here not that long ago, and I was like, wow, this city's really finally ruined this.
Yeah.
But maybe it's similar to this lag time you were talking about with writing your books and publishing them, mm-hmm. is that they come out as sort of, you know, you're writing in the present and then they end up describing the past. And I feel like that's true with these NFT metaverse things. It's like you organize the conference, and by the time that happened, the Fed had raised interest rates. No one gave a shit about NFTs anymore.
No, absolutely. No, and there was actually, like, I actually got a pretty negative review in, I think, the Irish Times, that was something like, this is a depiction of a dystopia that already feels dated. And I was like, I'm a historian. Thank you. Like, you complimented me. They're like, first of all, why wouldn't I want the dystopia I was describing to be over? Like, it was a fair review. Like, I have no contention with the review, but the idea that, you know, I've described something that is now in the past is, I think, it's like an occupational hazard of the historian, for sure. Like, I had to struggle with my editor, where the editor was just like, what's coming next? Like, you can't say it's over. You can't say rise and fall of the metaverse. You need to say, like, rise and rise. But, like, I kind of think it's fallen. Like, you know, we just have to, like, accept the fact that historians are bad at predicting the future. But actually, to respond to one of your questions earlier about the kind of mixture of, like, the archaic and the futuristic, that is something that is, I think, really part of this imaginary. And whether it's Hong Kong in that case, or David Friedman, pretending he's an 11th century Berber poet or whatever, then it's a bracketing of the modern period as something that was an error or like a mistake, right? And I think at least I was very used to being trained with this idea that modernity was inescapable. It was filled with like paradoxes and tensions or whatever, contradictions. But you needed to just, like, there was no avoiding it. Like, the idea of universality or, like, equality or humanity. Like, these are just, like, that's the terrain of politics. And the amazing thing about the anarcho-capitalists and some of the more radical thinkers is they're just, like, why do we have to think that way? Like, what if we just said there is no universalism, there is no humanity as a single political concept? What if equality is meaningless? Then where would we begin our politics? We would begin in a very different place. We'd like assume difference. We'd assume like incommensurability. We'd assume that like communities will never, you know, merge or even want to communicate with one another. Like we assume like a fragmented, permanently fragmented like humanity. And then figure out, okay, what are the basic ground rules under which there can be some degree of like mutually advantageous exchange between these permanently separated communities.
Instead of just repealing the 20th century, as the quote goes, it's like repeal the whole half millennium or more.
Yeah, no, yeah. Totally. Yeah, no, that's what Hans Hermann Hoppe, who's a very interesting, you know, protege of Murray Rothbard, who I talk about a bit in the book, you know, his thing is the year 1000. Yeah, no, he's like, let's go back to the year 1000. He's like, Europe was filled with, you know, micro states and micro polities. And yet there was like a law merchant, which allowed for business people to move around the continent and like have their claims and contracts respected. But it wasn't overseen by any kind of a state or any kind of like a public law. It was just something that was mutually helpful. And so they worked it out for themselves. So that kind of like, yeah, and it's kind of like a China Miéville. Like, there's so much science fiction that exists in that. Neal Stephenson comes up a lot in my book, like that idea of hyper fragmented political landscapes, which somehow still have like commercial relationships with one another. And that's where, I mean, I guess it's probably a good time to talk about Liechtenstein.
Yeah, and I wanted to pivot there because, like I said, it really embodies a lot of these sort of tensions and relationships that I discussed earlier. You know, it's history as well as, you know, it's an international financial center that's this like tiny little piece of land. Just for reference, I mean, I'm sure people have heard of Liechtenstein, but how small it is kind of hard to overstate. 40,000 inhabitants and about 160 square kilometers. Just for contrast, in Berlin, where we are currently, 4 million people and about 900 square kilometers. So It's, you know, it doesn't even manage like a large European city in terms of total land. And yet it has, I believe, the highest GDP per capita anywhere in the world. And is a very successful financial center, as you say, not just finance, to industrialize to some extent too.
Which, sure, yeah. Hilti machine tools and stuff. No, it does industry as well. Dentures, very big on artificial teeth.
Oh, good. I don't think people would know very many details about Liechtenstein. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of one of the, it seems like one of those kind of silly little places where like you might have to identify the map at a pub quiz or something and it's no one can get it. But it's in your seventh chapter here, and you talk about its role in the decay of European empires. I mean, the same way that you talk about Singapore and Hong Kong and Canary Wharf is sort of the decay of the British Empire. There's a whole other set of cases that can't come from the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Mm-hmm. And they're very, it seems like the leadership of Liechtenstein is more openly ideological than some other places, or, you know, places we would consider tax havens. Other places, it might seem like, well, okay, we're just trying to get by. We're a small country. We got to do whatever we can do.
The Cayman Islands.
The Cayman Islands, or, you know, even Ireland or something, trying to, you know, trying to find a business model to succeed in the world. It seems like Liechtenstein, they've drunk their own Kool-Aid. Like, they really buy into this. You talk about, just a great name here, Prince Hans Adam II von und zu Liechtenstein, the world's fourth wealthiest monarch with a net worth of over $2 billion. And you talk about the royal family there actually has more money than the Windsors. So.
Yeah.
Tiny, tiny place, but ridiculous amount of money. Could you talk a little bit about the history of this and how Liechtenstein emerges from the sort of little niche piece of land to a very poor, isolated, not quite real country, only joining the UN in 1990, I believe, to now the wealthiest country per capita in the world?
Yeah.
We don't need to get into like the whole prehistory. Too much detail, but
no,
a little bit of it would be great.
I wouldn't want to. They're the perfect example of this sort of anachronistic remnant of a world before modernity, before popular sovereignty, before kind of an idea of the kind of unitary nation state as we understand it, along the lines of Napoleon's France, with like the army is the school of the nation, and the expansion of the idea of a national economy and so on in the 19th century. Their roots are having been bought by, you know, one of the members of the House of Liechtenstein, who himself lived in Vienna, was a member of the court, purchased it at some point in the early 1700s in order to have a seat in the imperial diet. So it was a way of like gaining prestige, basically, inside the courtly world of Vienna, and never went there. So he never went there. Many of his descendants never went there for a very, very long time. And they ultimately only took up residence. The members of the House of Liechtenstein only took up residence really in the Second World War, in the effort to get away from the Nazis.
It's like the 18th century version of buying a luxury flat in a country you don't live in to get a passport. It's like,
exactly. Yeah. So they move into this like ghost flat of a nation in the I can't remember if it was the late 1930s or 1940s, but immediately find a kind of role because they act as a kind of like along with Switzerland, an original space of being offshore, where even when things started to tighten around the Nazis, as far as the Western powers were concerned, they would still like have their corporate headquarters in Liechtenstein. And people would be storing money in Liechtenstein, and people would be purchasing citizenship in Liechtenstein as a way to get out. Some people who were indeed being persecuted, but other people who were just wanting to like sort of squirrel away their fortunes. And as someone like the historian Vanessa Ogle has described, it was with the introduction of income tax in the 1910s and 20s, really after the First World War, that the tax haven as we know it kind of begin to emerge, and Liechtenstein and Switzerland very quickly step in as willing occupants of that role. But the weird thing about Liechtenstein, especially with the rise to the throne of Hans Adam, is, as you say, it's not just a pragmatic decision for him. It's like a principled one. And he is like, you know, reading his Mises, his Ludwig von Mises, and trying to actually make Liechtenstein even more like libertarian than it is, most famously by trying to introduce a new constitution whereby originally he wanted everybody down to the individual to be able to secede, which is just ripped straight from this work of Ludwig von Mises's from the early 20th century. They eventually managed to talk him down to just like small communities, which you, as you just said, like Lichten says, already a small community. And so like, how small could you get? But the idea of a kind of alternative mode of nation, not just nationhood, but like national membership and belonging, which was, you know, primarily commercial. Like he quipped at some point that if people didn't want to pass his constitution, then maybe he'd just sell the country to Bill Gates. Because, you know, the 1706 or whatever version of that had been his ancestor who just bought a place on the open market. So why can't you sell it again? You know, trying to complete that short circuit from the early modern period into the postmodern period. So they have just taken advantage of being, you know, well located at the kind of interstices of a lot of major European powers. They have been squeezed more in recent years by the OECD and mostly the OECD. So it's unclear if they can remain the kind of secrecy, kind of ensuring tax haven that they have made their fortune on. But they are a quite explicit inspiration to the anarcho-capitalist community. So like part of the reason why I wrote the chapter in the first place is like reading about Hans Adam II speaking at a conference of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in the German, the German version of the Mises Institute. And then there was a piece about him that was said, you know, let 1,000 Lichtensteins bloom. So there is, you know, what Mao was in the 1960s to some young radicals, Lichtenstein is to some probably not so young radicals now. I can't remember if he was the author, but I know he's spoken highly of Lichtenstein, is another character who comes in late in my book, but he's really fun. This is Patrick Schumacher, who is the principal of Zaha Hadid Architects. After Hadid herself died, I think around 2008 or something, he took over and now, you know, has unbelievable number of extremely expensive projects, mostly in China and the Gulf, but is also like a completely devoted anarcho-capitalist and believes that ideally all decisions should be handed over to the market and sees Lichtenstein as a kind of like template for polities altogether.
And on this idea of letting 1,000 Lichtensteins bloom, do they really believe that? As I find it, the whole reason Lichtenstein can work is because it's different than the things around them. I mean, they, you know, as you talk about in the book, after the fall of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they kind of align themselves with Switzerland and then just become like a super Switzerland. Be like, all right, you think you can do financial secrecy and tax havens?
Yep.
Watch us. Yep. But they're right there. They're well located next to these very wealthy, rich countries in Europe. Like it kind of makes sense for them. Mm-hmm. So one, you can't really have 1,000 because there's only so many specific places that even exist for the historical contingency you talked about, but that also have that kind of natural endowments and advantages. You know, like if you're a rich person, you probably want to be kind of close to Paris and Germany, you know, wherever else. It's a decent place to be. Yep. And the other is that if everywhere is Lichtenstein, nowhere is Lichtenstein. Because why would you, if everywhere adopts the policies of a tax haven, then, well, why would the money go there? And so do they like
wrangle?
You can't really get it. You know, it's hard to get inside people's heads completely. But do they really get that this is basically a fallacy of composition? Or do they really think that this can all keep spreading and everywhere can just be these little paradises? Because it just seems like the reason that they're paradises for an anarcho-capitalist is because the rest of the world has welfare states and democracies and taxes and things like that. And they can only exist as the opposite of that rather than it all moving in that direction.
Yeah, no, I think I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know if the people that I'm writing about would necessarily disagree with you, but I think the best way to think about what they're proposing is like a, you know, a very deep specialization of economic functions globally, whereby the people, the place where they will be and the place where they will be sort of affiliated with and invested in will be like coasting on the surf of the wave of many other things that's happening below them. So it is definitely a vision of the kind of cutting edge of a service economy, that the places that they're building, the places that they imagine themselves living, are places that are like doing the highest end, like financial services, or else things like unregulated medical experimentation, or, you know, very high end real estate. So they imagine it's like Dubai. I mean, it's like ultra high net worth individuals like living in spaces that have sort of bespoke zoning codes, which allow for certain kinds of high value added like services. That assumes for sure that there's people doing everything else elsewhere, right? And I think like the sort of maybe easy critique, and it's one that I can't really say I've always been above, is to just sort of say like they're pretending that the rest of the reproduction of this whole, you know, global economy doesn't exist, and like they're forgetting about all the dirty work. But I don't know if they would really disagree. I think they'd be like, yeah, because it's dirty. Who wants to think about it? Like, you know, if China wants to continue to be the world's biggest steel producer and just like muddle through whatever kind of a political system they have happening there, then like, go for it. Like, as long as we will be the place where people who make the money, you know, run with their, you know, profits and hide when they can skim them out legally or illegally out of the country, then like, we've found our place in the International Division of Labor.
I see that. I just wonder then, why would they want it to proliferate? Because wouldn't that kind of undermine their position? Like, if there's 999 other versions of themselves, maybe they would lose some of that
high end. Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. But, I mean, so this is like, this takes you to the space of like the sovereign individual, which is like the James Dale Davidson and William Rees-Mogg book, which is kind of a Bible for people like Peter Thiel and Balaji Srinivasan. And they even put a number on it. They're like, there's going to be like 200,000, I think, like sovereign individuals. And so could the world sustain like 1,000 Liechtensteins? And then, you know, the rest of the world is all like slaving away in some kind of like legacy, like bloated states and like with collapsing welfare systems? Maybe. Like 1,000 might be kind of on the edge, but you could imagine like a network of 500 private cities, which is what they would think about. And that's the dream to which they're working, is enough places to accommodate. And they often would say openly kind of like the genetically well-endowed, intelligent class who can figure out how to do arbitrage and like tap into and skim off of the work of all these other people well enough to exist happily.
And as we approach the end here, I also want to use Liechtenstein to tie into two other themes that you discuss a lot, both in your mm-hmm. books and some of your writing in, you know, magazines and newspapers and so on. One is the relationship with the European Union or Europe mm-hmm. in general, and the other is the far right as we know it, the sort of, I guess, like the dirty far right that the polite commentariat would say, oh, they're bad and scary, like the AfD, whereas mm-hmm. as opposed to the sort of more sterile, pristine economic right, which you frequently point out are very, very connected, mm-hmm. and Liechtenstein mm-hmm. shows that to some extent. Mm-hmm. And so first to start with the EU, and you mentioned the OECD and them trying to crack down on the tax haven status. Mm-hmm. I think they were removed from the blacklist, and the EU did that as well between 2017 and 2019. Liechtenstein mm-hmm. altered some kind of secrecy thing a little bit. And so now they're no longer on whatever negative list of tax havens. So the EU has been putting some pressure on them. At the same time, there's a lot of people in Europe who really like the Liechtenstein model. Mm. You quote a few different people here. For example, you talk about the historian Paul Johnson, who argued that the so-called feudal system, often used as a synonym for backwardness, was in fact a series of ingenious devices to fill the power vacuum left by the fall of Rome, and sort of glamorizes the Dark Ages a little bit,
yeah.
Which, okay, I mean, if you want to move back there, go for it, man. And then you also cite a German economist who said, quote, "The European culture is the most successful in world history, not despite, but because it is fragmented into so many small countries that compete with one another." And saying that the ideal Europe is a free market of states. So again, this it's a different way of saying let a thousand Liechtensteins bloom, but saying, you know, Europe as a whole will be better off if we can have all these tiny little states mm-hmm. competing with each other. And so how does maybe Liechtenstein specifically, it's a pretty small case, so it might be hard to extrapolate too much, but this idea of small states competing, how does that relate to the kind of the regional integrated market of Europe, and how do they both relate to mm-hmm. neoliberalism? Because as you talked about at the start, there's very different ways of looking at neoliberalism, of saying, you know, we want these like overarching constitutions, or no, we want these tiny little entities all competing with each other.
No, it's a really good question. I think that it's one of the reasons why I find it very unsatisfying when people simply are like happy with this idea that like the EU is neoliberal, like let's move on, like that's like settled. Not at all. I think that interestingly, this is actually something that didn't make it into the book, but I've written about elsewhere, but like if you look at the origins of something like UKIP, UK Independence Party, you know, like founded in the LSE offices of the historian Alan Sked in the early 1990s. Now, what was Sked vibing on? Like, why was he against the European Union? Well, he was reading historians. I mean, he was reading Eric Jones on the European Miracle, who was a medieval historian. He was reading Paul Kennedy about like sort of the rise and fall of great powers. And the kind of consensus in the historical community was the one that you just mentioned. It was not controversial at all. It was like, actually, well, what accounts for Europe's rise? Well, that you had a lot of small polities like competing with each other. And actually, the lack of coordination, the lack of harmonization, the lack of integration was good. And like, it led to, you know, people imitating each other when they had solved problems better or whatever. And this is like, I'm not necessarily, you know, equipped to intervene in that debate as it pertains to like the early modern period. But it is interesting how that became a kind of a legitimate basis for like a Euroskeptical position. You don't even have to worry about the democratic deficit or like being ruled by Brussels or being ruled by Berlin or anything. You just have to say that actually Europe's diversity is its strength. And to try to do harmonization is undermining that strength. And I think you're right that like there are two ways of thinking about a neoliberal Europe. And one would be to say the problem with EU as it exists now is it is actually like drowned out and squeezed out like that very, you know, salutary competition. The other way of seeing it as a neoliberal Europe is like the one version one, you know, the most austere, the most like anti-redistributive, the most like pro-private version in that scrum of different competing visions at the end of the European subcontinent won, and then, you know, enshrined itself as the EU. So then what we're not seeing is like the reverse of that long process of competition, but like the culmination of it where the most pro-capitalist, pro-austerity version of Europe was victorious. But I think that, you know, the answer is between, which is like, I think that the model of what the EU is like as yet undecided. I think competition policy is like a really great thing to follow if you're, you know, interested in the kind of ongoing ambivalence of what the EU is. You know, it is indeed something that the ordo-liberals thought was like the best part of the European project in the 60s onward, which was like the way that private corporations could kind of trump public states and in enforcing competition across borders. But now, for sure, it's being used sometimes in a different direction, like for breaking the need for kind of the need for undermining state subsidies, the need to like to prioritize like price competitiveness in the interest of things like, you know, resilience and strategic autonomy and climate transition and so on. So I think that the thing that has probably been most interesting to me about looking at neoliberal intellectual history and Europe is that it's like, for me, reopen the question of what Europe is. Like, it's especially in the US, I guess it's probably true in Europe too, but like the field of European studies is like just for decades been like the most boring subfield that exists because it's funded by the people who, you know, who want a particular answer and they want the answer that the EU is good. So European studies said the EU is basically good. But from Strake onwards and whatever, the Eurozone crisis onwards, you know, I think the question has been open, not, you know, how evil is the EU, but like, what is the EU? What is Europeanism? What kind of versions of the past inform it? What versions of the past is it trying to emulate and get back to? So I think that my hope for working on neoliberalism as a topic is not to provide an easy answer to everything, which I think is how neoliberalism is sometimes used. It's just like, it's a way to end arguments rather than start, you know, investigations. But I think if you use a complex understanding of the intellectual history of neoliberalism, you find that the question of like how to protect capitalism from democracy is never has one answer. It's always like many answers, people disagreeing, even inside their own camp. So, you know, the question of do you have a greater Liechtenstein or do you have a greater France is like, that's still at the heart, I think, of what Europe should be or the future of it should look like.
Yeah, and it's like you said, the kind of just so bedtime story of Europe is very unsatisfying of, oh, we had war and then we came together and you know, now everything's great.
Yeah.
We would both find that unsatisfying, obviously. But the opposite of this is the complete triumph of capitalism and inequality and it's just neoliberalism. Okay, you know, maybe true in some ways, but if it's such a capitalist dream, why do so many capitalists hate it so much?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's an interesting moment now because it is the case, I think, that the U.S., at least formally speaking, in the Biden administration, has rhetorically a more kind of post-neoliberal position than the EU does. And I think that that's been kind of disorienting for Europeans to be like, wait a sec, huh? But no, we're the more lefty ones compared to America. We always have been. And you, at least, you know, on paper, you have Biden administration people saying like, no, we are actually now welcoming the state and bringing back industrial policy or whatever.
No maternity leave yet, but yeah.
It's riven with contradictions. But at least there's the kind of, I think it's a good feeling for especially Germans maybe, and even like German Greens. I was talking to some journalists about this the other day, to sort of feel that they are being lapped or outpaced as it forces them to say like, wait, what do we actually, what is our model actually? You know, like what are the things we're going to the mat for and against whom and for what? And I would hope that, you know, after that gut check, you know, not putting too much hope in this, but then, you know, SPD and Green people might sort of think like that the idea of post-neoliberalism should be as welcome to them as it is to their Atlantic, you know, siblings.
Yeah, it seems like, as happens quite a bit, the U.S. is able to turn on a dime quite a bit, and then the Europeans have really kind of drunk the Kool-Aid, and they say, like, wait, but I thought we had all these rules-based order. We can't, you know, we have the single market. We can't intervene. That's not the level playing field.
Right,
and
right.
The U.S. is like, yeah, we were just saying that. It suited us. Now we're done with that. And it's like, it's been a very weird last year plus here because for a while, you know, being from the U.S. and being in Europe, felt kind of smug being over here. Like, oh my, the U.S. is completely falling apart. Europe is feeling a little bit better about itself. And all of a sudden in the last, yeah, about 18 months or so, there's like this crazy crisis of confidence here. And no one, it seems like European, especially policy types, just cannot figure out, yeah, like you said, what they stand for, what their kind of USP is anymore. And it's been very disorienting to see now the U.S. being so blustering and confident. I don't think justifiably so, but that switch since the Trump era to now of who feels like they're on the right track is really crazy.
Yeah. Well, when you turn on a dime, it's always very important to remember that the dime is denominated in U.S. dollars.
What do you even call 10 euro cents? It doesn't even have a catchy name, does it?
No, it doesn't.
And the last topic, as I mentioned here, that I want to get to is the actual, the far right, as we think about it today, that people post, you know, graphs of the polling in Germany and say, oh, this is, you know, this is very, very scary. I don't mean to sound glib when I say that. It is a bit scary to see the AfD in second place in a lot of national polls.
Yeah.
For example, like Thuringia is going to have an election, their state election next year. Looks like the AfD is going to run away with it with about, you know, a third of the vote total, with by far the biggest share. And this also, which I found interesting and surprising, relates to the Liechtenstein thing. Hans Adam II, you say he stood along other Euroskeptics, and in 2013, he appeared at a gathering of neoliberals and nationalists with the economist Bernd Lucke, who had just founded the Alternative for Germany, soon to become the first far-right party to enter the Bundestag. Just as a bit of a segue there, that this all really links together, these tiny little neoliberal paradises and the actual existing far-right parties in major European countries. These people are all hanging out with each other in the Hayek Society and everything like this. Could you talk a bit about how you see the AfD is relating to neoliberalism? Because something I find very frustrating is that people will talk about this kind of backlash that we mentioned earlier, that there's, you know, neoliberalism's gone too far, people are unhappy with it, and there's a backlash, and they're angry, and so now they're pushing back against, you know, globalization and neoliberalism and voting for parties like the AfD,
right,
which would seem to imply that they're somehow anti-capitalist or at least anti-neoliberal. And in so many cases, these parties that people cite as the backlash against capitalism and neoliberalism are extremely neoliberal themselves. We just saw yesterday in Italy, the Meloni of the Brothers of Italy, who people were saying similar things about, oh, you know, there's this backlash against the economic circumstances, people want more protection, just cuts social welfare dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So how does the kind of cultural anti-immigrant far right that I think the liberal commentariat is very scared of, how does that relate to the neoliberal right? And as I said, you know, earlier, you point out frequently, there's not as much of a firewall between these at all. Indeed, quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it depends and it changes over time. So like, I think especially if you look at Europe, there are sort of different genuses of far-right parties. So I think it's more possible to talk about the right wing of the Conservative Party in the UK alongside the German-speaking far-right parties like the Freedom Party in Austria and the the Swiss People's Party, SVP, in Switzerland, and the AfD in Germany. They kind of act in similar ways that isn't always the same as, say, the Front National, the Rassemblement National, or even the Lega. Even though, you know, as historians who've been working on this stuff since the 90s or political scientists will point out, in the 90s, most of these far-right populist parties were identified by like what you would just simply call neoliberal politics, right? They were against excessive welfare spending. They were against sort of restrictions on their higher taxes. They were against the restrictions on the rights of business people. And they tended to, one after the other, kind of drift more towards welfare chauvinism and to sort of make peace with the social state as they saw that that's what the electorate wanted. So the AFD itself kind of performed that shift in miniature from its founding to, you know, a few years after that, when they found out that, you know, like ragging on Muslims and immigrants was much more effective than
founded as a really an anti-Euro, the currency party in the wake of the Euro crisis and really worried about redistribution to the south of Europe. Like that's it started out as an economic party. Absolutely. And then it became the anti-immigrant party.
Yeah, I mean, it was founded by economics professors. Bernd Lucke was a professor at the University of Hamburg. Broadly in the ordo-liberal tradition, who basically felt like that the EU and the European Monetary Union more pertinently had been kind of taken over by the socialists and the leftists and the redistributors. And Merkel was doing no one any favors by her bailouts to the south, right? So it was a kind of a topsy-turvy world if you've been used to reading the actual news, which is like, wait, handouts to Greece? It's not really what was happening. But nevertheless, they saw the world through that looking glass way and thought that the Eurozone crisis was actually an act of like expansionary socialism. And what you needed to do is get back to the Deutschmark. So the alternative for Germany is the alternative to Euro is back to the Deutschmark. So that's where they began the strongly economistic kind of thinking. But how they got then to where they are now, I think that there's a couple of helpful ways to think about it. One is through money and the other is through people. So the money question is really, you know, it's extraordinary that the European countries that joined the EMU were willing to, like, you know, just nuke their own currencies and just embrace this totally made up one with just, like, you know, pretty faceless, you know, affectively uninspiring bills. And
famously with fake bridges because they didn't, the Euro notes have these like made up bridges because they couldn't actually pick any from a real country because it would like get nationalist sentiments stirred up too much. So they built these fake bridges, I believe, in the Netherlands that they just then took pictures of and put them on the bills. Just to illustrate your point that this is like
a generic placeless thing, like AI version of what Europe is.
Yeah.
I mean, for cultural historians and even economic historians, it's like money is so important. It's wild to think that you would think that you could do away with that with no consequences. So one of the ways you can think about neoliberalism and the far right is just like a fight over like what's the right kind of money for Europe. And it's not just what the right kind of bills, but like what should the monetary constitution be, as they would call it. And that's where you do get differences, right? I mean, like someone like Salvini and Meloni are much more willing to say, like, just spend, like do a kind of right-wing MMT, whereas others like the Austrian Freedom Party or the AFD really still make a lot of hay on the idea of austerity and overspending and the need to like bring back kind of fiscal prudence. So that's one way I think there's a very clear through lines from the neoliberal ideology to far right stuff is just like often this idea of austerity, fiscal responsibility, matching up the kind of money to some sort of depoliticized version of value, which is, of course, fantasy, but that's one they entertain and spend a lot of energy entertaining. The other is about people. And there the assumption, I think, is often that the rejection of immigration is based purely on so-called ethno-nationalist grounds, that, you know, there's something about non-white people or non-Christian peoples that is like incompatible in sort of an abstract way with like the values of Christian ethnically German society, to use the AFD example. And that's, you know, true to a certain extent. But there is also a whole discourse, which I think is very useful to understand, that, you know, is if you look at the work of someone like Tilo Sarrazin, who the former SPD member whose work has probably been, or most people agree, has been the most important in producing the kind of intellectual and cultural conditions for the breakthrough of the far right. When he opposed immigration, it wasn't only in sort of abstract terms of like cultural compatibility or like values. He used a very economic logic, which is like that first his belief was that people from, you know, Arab countries, Turkish countries had lower IQ And that's something he has, you know, had and has in his footnotes, citing all kinds of discredited scientific racists like Richard Lynn and so on. And because they have low IQ, they have a low capacity to kind of plan for the future, and they, you know, seek instantaneous gratification and pleasure in the short term. And so as economic actors, they're like dysfunctional. So they're like, you wouldn't want to hire these people. You wouldn't want to give these people welfare payments, not because they believe in Allah or whatever, but because they're just bad economic actors. And a lot of the kind of more quote unquote intellectual wing of far right parties use this kind of not blood and soil argumentation about immigration, but kind of like dollars and cents, sort of actuarial or like prudential reading of it. And that's part of the way they sort of distance themselves from like more Nazi style, like spiritual racists. It's like, no. It's not just because of Blüten Boden. It's because of just, you know, the latest in IQ science. So there you can see real continuities with people like obviously Charles Murray, who did the most to re-mainstream IQ science in the 1990s. And even when there's a kind of shift towards more welfare chauvinism and away from that kind of austerity-mindedness of more early far-right populists or even early AfD, you can still often see that like a kind of exposure of social problems to an economistic logic. But there, you know, it's not set in advance, I think. You know, the AfD is a great example. Like you had curious alliances of ordoliberal economists with sort of pretty spiritual, like people sitting out in Schnellroda and like reading sort of Steiner type mysticism. I mean, that's obviously part of the AfD coalition as well. And whether or not they end up, the Flügel, as it's called, the kind of right-wing ethno-nationalist group who perhaps care less about economics, end up sort of setting the tone and perhaps, you know, winning the most support by setting the tone is also a potential outcome. I don't think it's foreordained that like neoliberalism will always be the winning argument. I think that it is also a way of explaining the far right that like certain neoliberal rationality made far right arguments more palatable at a certain moment and then maybe have less salience or importance, you know, later on.
It's a fitting place to leave it in this, you know, we both come to the city a lot. You know, I live here, you visit quite a bit. And so I think we have this like fondness for this country in general, mm-hmm. the city in particular. And it, like I said, it's weird to see the mood really drop quite a bit. You know, recent polling, only a quarter of Germans are optimistic about the future, which is actually a decrease. It's not just that Germans are always grumpy, which, mm-hmm. you know, there's a bit to that, but mm-hmm. there has been a change over time. And 80% are currently unhappy with the government. And then, like you said, there's this, you know, the alternative, of course, is a mix of race science and neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And then I guess on the other side, maybe we have the Wagenknecht splinter party and Die Linke fracturing, which we talked about a couple episodes ago. Mm-hmm. It's a weird place to be and not, you know, I don't have anything on the tip of my tongue to wrap things up on a happy note, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you could even, I think, go darker, which is like, which is like, I think I've spent, you know, the last few years on this motif of the way that neoliberalism and fascism or far right politics are not opposites and are often like deeply intertwined with one another. But I think that it is possible to imagine, especially under, you know, pressures of demographic shift and kind of climate breakdown, to imagine like a purer far right politics, more along the lines of the kind of climate fascism that Andreas Malm and company describe, which maybe like takes leave of a certain kind of market rationality and takes comfort in like precisely the kind of mysticisms and kind of non-economic qualities of a connection to nature, a connection to the land, a connection to blood that, you know, indeed like short circuits us back towards the early modern period.
Well, I guess that's the big question here is, yeah, how many centuries are we going to repeal in the coming decades?
That's
right. So we'll keep you posted on that. But Quinsilbodian, thanks so much for coming on for an extremely interesting, if not entirely uplifting conversation.
Yeah.
But it's been a real pleasure.
You're welcome. It was nice to be here.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Cheers.
Cheers.
Very nice. Very nicely done. All right. Catch you next time, everyone. Done.